This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people have asked the question, why did someone leave the cake out in the rain with all that sweet green icing flowing down? My guest, Jimmy Webb, is the person best equipped to answer that. He wrote the elliptical song MacArthur Park, and it sure did well for him. Three versions made it to the charts, by Richard Harris, The Four Tops, and Donna Summer. Glenn Campbell had big hits with the Jimmy Webb songs, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, The Wichita Lineman, and Galveston. Webb's other hit songs include Didn't We, Up, Up, and Away, and The Worst That Could Happen. He got his start in the business as a staff songwriter from Motown. Last year, Jimmy Webb received the Johnny Mercer Award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Now Michael Feinstein has a new CD of Jimmy Webb's popular and lesser-known songs. We invited Jimmy Webb to tell us some of the stories behind his hit songs of the 60s and 70s. Let's talk about one of your best-known songs, and that is By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I was reading this is the third most performed song in the last 50 years, according to BMI, who should know. How did you write the song?
Well, it's more of a song about something I wish I had done than something I really did, in that I did not get in my car and drive back to Oklahoma to punish this young woman for not reciprocating my love and affection. In fact, a guy approached me one night after a concert, and he had a map, and he had all the times, and he had a stopwatch, and he showed me how it was impossible for me to drive from L.A. to Phoenix, and then how far it was to Albuquerque. And then, in short, he told me, this song is impossible. And so it is. It's a kind of fantasy about something I wish I would have done, and it sort of takes place in a twilight zone of reality. May I hasten to add that I think that the appeal of the song lies in its sort of succinct tale, its beginning, middle, and end, and the fact that it sort of has an O. Henry-esque twist at the end, which consists merely of the guy saying, she didn't really think that I would go, but he did. And in fact, I didn't. I didn't go. I stayed for more punishment.
Does the woman or girl, I don't know how old you were, that you wrote this for, know that it was about her?
Oh, yes, she does. And she's still, thankfully, she's very much alive, and she's actually married into the Ronstadt clan. Her name is Susan Ronstadt now. And she and I are very, very close friends, and there were many, many songs that were inspired by her and came about as a result of our very young relationship. High school. She was a high school sweetheart. We actually went to Disneyland together on graduation night. And that picture still exists, unfortunately. I was wearing the worst sort of plaid sports jacket you had ever seen in your life.
It sounds like this torch is still dimly burning.
Well, I believe that all torches are inextinguishable to some degree, no matter what human beings say about that subject. And I just do believe that once that fire is kindled, it lasts forever. You do love that person forever.
Well, I think this would be a good time to hear the Glenn Campbell version of By the Time I Get to Phoenix, written by my guest, Jimmy Webb.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, 'cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing off the wall. That's all. By the time I make Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping.
Glenn Campbell's hit of the Jimmy Webb song, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. And by the way, there's a new album of Jimmy Webb songs recorded by Michael Feinstein. By the Time I Get to Phoenix started a short series of place songs, you know, Galveston, Wichita, mm-hmm. Lineman. Did you start to think that if you put a place name in the song that it would hit?
No, it wasn't so much my doing as it was deliberate manipulation on the part of A&R and the labels and in their attempts to engineer what we called in those days a follow-up record. But I remember particularly the day that they called me about Wichita and said, Glenn's looking for a follow-up for By the Time I Get to Phoenix. But it's got to be a place. And I thought, well, okay. I didn't particularly like that idea. I'm not someone who thinks that way or creates that way. But I'm a young songwriter, and I think I've got the chops to do it. And I sit down, and I spend maybe an hour and 45 minutes or 2 hours working on a song. I come up with a concept based on some memories I have of some blue-collar guys working on telephone lines around liberal Kansas and the panhandle of Oklahoma out there in that great kind of land of no horizon. And I called them up, and I said, I've got a song over here. I said, but I don't really think it's finished. And they said, well, send it over anyway. And I sent it over. And they called me back in a state of exaltation over what I had written, and they put it out, and it became this huge hit. And this song has had people still tell me, and it bothers me a little bit, because when I was writing my book on songwriting, Tunesmith, I actually for the first time analyzed some of my songs, and I was really shocked and appalled at what I found. And one of the things that I found was that in Wichita Lineman, there's a line that goes like this: and I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita Lineman is still on the line. And the first thing I thought of when I read it is false rhyme. That's a false rhyme. That's
line and biggest, time.
That's the most biggest, awfulest, dumbest, most obvious false rhyme in history. And night after night, at performance after performance, person after person comes up to me. Until now, I'm talking about 100,000 people have walked up to me and said, you know the greatest line you ever wrote? I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. You know? And so, I don't know how to explain that. I wouldn't have, had I known what I was doing, I wouldn't have written that line. I would have found a way to make it rhyme. It was only years later that I became aware of what a songwriter was even supposed to do. I was really just a kid who was kind of writing from the hip and the heart.
So it bothered you that line and time aren't a perfect rhyme?
Well, now it does.
Uh-huh.
Now it does, because those are the kinds of things that can just get you like thoroughly drubbed and punished and flogged and scourged. You know, on in the Broadway arena,
they send you to lyricist prison for that.
Yeah, yeah, the false rhyme police come to your house, and you just don't do that. You just can't do that. It's just so verboten.
Why don't we hear Freddie Johnson's version of that? You familiar with the version?
I've heard it, and I like it.
Good, me too. Let's hear it.
I'm a lineman for the county, and I ride the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wires, I hear you through the wine, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. You know I need a short vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south will never take the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all.
Now, you grew up in Oklahoma. Your father was a Baptist minister. How did the church figure into your daily life and into your musical life as a child?
It was a totally all-encompassing influence, in that when you're the son of a Southern Baptist minister, you are informed at a very early age that you are part and parcel of his ministry, and that your behavior reflects on his image in the community, and therefore your every movement, your every word, everything that you do is monitored. And that includes the music that you play, the music that you listen to. And my mother's dream from the very beginning, when she started me on piano at 6 years of age, was that I would be church pianist. And I was. By the time I was 12 years old, I was the church pianist, and I had also moved over to organ, and was a large part of the musical program in the church. And we did specials. We sang three-part. My father played guitar. My mother played accordion. I can just remember the top of my mother's head sticking over this big Hohner accordion. She was short, and the accordion was taller than she was.
Well, that sounds very hip, guitar, accordion, and piano.
Oh, it was pretty cool, and we learned some very, very useful things. I mean, to improvise three-part harmony on the fly, I mean, that's a pretty cool thing to learn when you're a kid. And it also got us up in front of people and got us, and I say us because I had siblings. I had a brother and three sisters, and we all sang.
Now, your family moved to Southern California, to San Bernardino, in 1964. Did your father get a church there?
Yes, he was pastoring in Colton. And I finished my high school in Colton. I graduated as a senior from Colton High School. It was the year that JFK was assassinated. And it was also the year that my mother died. And so it was really quite an eye-opener for me. And it's interesting to note that my mother, after expending these huge reserves of energy, sort of lashing me into a somewhat formidable young musician, that she died before I ever did anything. She never heard me. She never heard one of my songs on the radio. She never saw me get one award. She never saw one piece of sheet music on the piano with my name on it. I have regrets about that, because had she lived just a little bit longer, I think she would have been really proud of me, you know?
Sure.
So all of a sudden I was exposed to the Beach Boys, which was like, it was like a fish to water. I mean, I loved Southern California. I loved the lifestyle. I loved the Beach Boys. I loved the Righteous Brothers. And I just wanted to get into it. I wanted to get into the record business.
Did your father love you
stop,
doing that?
You know, no, he didn't. And because one of the precepts of the Baptist Church, Terry, is that we do not believe in dancing. The Southern Baptist Church does not believe in dancing. In fact, Glenn Campbell told me a story once. He said, Jimmy, he says, you know why Baptists don't make love standing up, don't you? And I said, no, how come? He says, because he's afraid, they're afraid people will think they're dancing. That's kind of a typical Glenn Campbell story. I think it's a pretty good one. But, you know, I had to sort of sneak out of the house to play dances, which I did, because, hey, you could pick up 15 or 20 bucks. And I had three or four guys I played with. When the Beatles came along, I was playing Dave Brubeck. Dave Brubeck had a brother named Howard, and Howard laboriously transcribed every note that Dave Brubeck ever played, including all of Paul Desmond's solos and everything else. It was all in ink, pen and ink. And we, with equal fervor, digested all of these transcriptions and learned to play Dave Brubeck, and we could cough it up. We could play Blue Rondo a la Turk, just like Howard had written it down.
The year your mother died, your father moved back to Oklahoma. Did he want you? Didn't. You stayed in California. Did your father want you to go with him?
He sure did. I remember we were standing in San Bernardino, California, in the parking lot of the Palm Paradise Palm Motel. And my dad had the car packed, and he and my sisters, my brothers was in the car. And I was standing there, and I said, Dad, I'm not going. I said, there's no way in the world that I'm going back to Oklahoma after coming all this way and being this close to Hollywood. I just have to try it. I have to try it. He said, son, he said, this songwriting thing, he says, it's just going to break your heart. And P.S., he was right about that more than once. But he said, but, and he dug down in his pocket, and he came up with $40. And he said, son, he says, this is all I've got. But he says, it's yours. And he gave me $40, and he got in his caravan, his little trailer truck thing, and off he went. And that was a lonely, very isolated moment in time, standing there in a parking lot with these neon lights blinking, these kind of electronic palm trees blinking on and off over my head, going, now what have I done? How am I going to handle this?
How long was it between that moment and getting your contract working for Motown Publishing?
Well, it was not much longer than a year. I borrowed $1,000 from some friends of mine in Newport Beach. I bought a VW. It cost me $600. And I started. I was going to junior college. And I was a music major, and not doing very well because my mind was on something else. And just eking by on whatever money I could make on gigs. But about a year later, I had, you know, after exhausting every other opportunity, I walked into the offices at Jobette, and Vicky, this big woman who sat behind the reception desk, says, honey, you must be lost. And she had a good laugh, and I sat down and talked to her for a while, and she ended up taking one of my tapes into the inner sanctum of the office at Jobette and playing it, and I could hear it playing through the door. And after the song, the door opened, and a young man, black man named Frank Wilson, stuck his head out the door and cocked his head at me and said very, very softly, said, would you come in here, please? And that was literally the moment. It was like the allegorical moment, if you will, when the door opened for me.
You started writing hit songs at an interesting time in the history of radio. You know, we're talking the latter part of the 1960s, so it's a time when you still have pop music on AM, and you have the beginnings of, you know, quote, progressive rock on the FM. And
Underground, we used to call it.
Yeah. So your songs were falling a bit on both, weren't they?
I was very fortunate that way. If it hadn't been for FM, quote, underground, unquote, radio, MacArthur Park would have never been broken as a single, because Top 40 was not going to play MacArthur Park. It was 7 minutes and 20 seconds long. Parentheses, and Hey Jude is 7 minutes, 21 seconds long. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. But MacArthur Park would never have broken on Top 40. And in fact, I remember Ron Jacobs calling me from KHJ in Los Angeles and saying, we'll go on MacArthur Park, but you have to edit it for us. And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. And they said, well, you realize what you're doing. I mean, you're throwing away a hit record. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to edit it, because that's what it is. And a week later, they were on it. And as soon as stations like KHJ started playing MacArthur Park in its entirety, forget it. It rolled across the country. It was inescapable. And I felt terrible for people like Herbert Saul at Newsweek magazine, who lamented in a whole page of Newsweek that he had spent his entire summer trying to escape MacArthur Park, and that he had finally gone to Martha's Vineyard and gotten on a sailboat and sailed way out to a tiny little island and gotten on a beach, and this woman came walking by with a transistor radio, and the mournful saccharine strings of MacArthur Park, you know, leaked from her transistor radio so that he had actually found it was truly inescapable.
And it's your fault. MacArthur Park and Stairway to Heaven are two of the most, like, baffling lyrics in the history of pop songs. So let's go over the lyric a little bit.
Let's don't.
No, we have to. We have to. Well.
Anyway, go ahead. I know we have to do this.
We have to do this. So, you know, with my apologies, here we go. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing melting down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can make it, but it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
I don't think that I can take it, because it took so long to bake it.
Sorry. So, I mean, God, you know, you rewrite it in your mind, and that's the way you sing it to yourself.
Anyway, you can freely substitute. I don't really think it matters that much.
What were you thinking about when you wrote this? What is it?
Well, I was thinking about the end of a love affair, in a very lurid sort of melodramatic terms, because this whole love affair had taken place in and about the environs of MacArthur Park in Los Angeles, which in those days was this kind of lovely little park with ducks and things. Now it's like I don't know what it is. I think it's even smaller. I think they've chopped it down into a smaller piece of real estate. But there were boats there, and it passed for a romantic place when one was a teenager. And so really, I make no defense of the lyrics of MacArthur Park. They were written in a hallucinogenic era when actually such lyrics are quite common, and most of them don't need to be defended. It was an era of that kind of thing.
See, you're using the psychedelic defense.
Well, it's not even a defense. I think I stand by MacArthur Park. I think that it's completely unique, and it is a very viable attempt to coalesce rock and classical music and sort of format something for the radio that has movements, that has a kind of grandiose symphonic feeling to it. I'm really not, and I did the arrangement myself. I won a Grammy for it. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything to defend, really. It was just part of a lot of kind of careless lyric writing.
Now, it's interesting, you know, it does have this, you know, kind of like trippy lyric about the cake melting in the rain and everything. And, you know, Richard Harris had the hit, and he, you know, I don't think he struck anybody as being particularly of, you know, like the groovy psychedelic era. So it was kind of odd mashing in a way.
He thought he was.
Mm-hmm. Well, judging from, I'm looking at the album jacket of the CD reissue, yeah. And I don't know if this is the same thing that was on the album, but there's a picture of him in a park. I don't know if it's the park.
Yeah.
Wearing like a black
looking
robe.
Looking very sullen.
Yes, is seated in this kind of throne with a red headband tied around his forehead.
Yeah, well, he saw himself that way, too. He always saw himself on a throne. In fact, he ended his career playing kings. He played Caesar and then in Harry Potter, he was playing the king of the magicians, but he was a king. And I just want to tell you that before we say too much about him, that I just attended a memorial service for him in London, and Patty Maloney and Liam Neeson and all the Celtic crowd came out to say goodbye to Richard, who was one of the great colorful figures of our age. And to me, even though I think I could say without fear of contradiction that this much maligned song, MacArthur Park, has been recorded probably 200 or 300 times by everybody from the Four Tops to Frank Sinatra. But my favorite version of it is still Richard Harris's.
Did he want to ask you anything about the song before he actually recorded it?
No. You know what he said? He said, "I'll have that."
He was talking about striped pants in the lyrics, and he says striped. Did you want him to say striped?
I can give you something much better than that. The name of the song is MacArthur Park. All the way through, he sung MacArthur's Park. MacArthur's Park is melting into that. He sung MacArthur's Park, and he couldn't be dissuaded from that. Artists change my lyrics throughout my whole career in that way, and sometimes they get something in their head and you can't get it out.
Well, let's hear Richard Harris's version of your song, MacArthur Park.
Oh, let's do.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in. Between the parted pages, and we're pressed in love's hot fevered iron, like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no. I recall the yellow cotton dress.
That's Richard Harris's hit recording of MacArthur Park, a song written by my guest, Jimmy Webb. And there's a new CD of all Jimmy Webb songs recorded by Michael Feinstein. What did you think when Donna Summer had her hit disco version of MacArthur Park?
Well, first of all, I was not a great disco fan, but I am a great Donna Summer fan, and I think she's got these great pipes, and she really sang the song. It was also just from a purely financial point of view, it was, and this is probably one of those asterisk quotes at the bottom of my career somewhere. It was the only number one record I've ever had in the United States.
Really?
And I remember, yes, because everything else, you know, through my heyday, I was battling the Beatles, and the Beatles quite often held down the top three spots, sometimes the top five. MacArthur Park was kept out of number one by a Beatles record. I don't remember which one it was, but they just sat there. They just sat there for 16 weeks and kept us out of number one. So MacArthur Park was never higher than Two with a Bullet with Richard Harris. And a lot of those records were stuck either in the top 10 or in the high teens, because the Beatles held down so many slots. And here it was, finally, my first number one record. And I remember the day it went number one, and I remember what I did. I hired a limousine, and I drove around Hollywood all day long, saying to myself, I have the number one record. I'm number one. I'm number one. I'd roll down the window, and the guy next to me, I'd say, I'm number one. And they're going, who is that guy? Is he nuts? I'm number one. Hey.
Do you see yourself as straddling different eras, you know, of having like one foot in the rock era and one foot in the popular song era?
Oh, I think it's inescapable. I think it's absolutely true, and in many ways I've been fortunate because of that, because I've had a breadth of experience. The artists that I was conversant with, the fact that Johnny Mercer would call me up and ask me if I was interested in writing a song with him, is quite incredible when you place it alongside. For instance, the fact that Lowell George, who founded Little Feat, recorded one of my songs on his solo album, and that I played piano on Jumpin' to the Fire on Nielsen Schmielsen, and that my first song was recorded by the Supremes. It was a Christmas song called My Christmas Tree. And so I've been almost extraordinarily fortunate to have been able to live in those two worlds and to intimately embrace those two worlds, to have been at the recording session in London when the Beatles recorded Honey Pie, to have been sitting there watching them play. So it is... It's really, if variety is the spice of life, then, you know, my life has been well seasoned.
Jimmy Webb, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a long time dream of mine to talk to you, Terry.
I'm honored to hear you say that. Thank you. It's melting in the dark on the sweet green ice. That's Donna Summer. A new CD of Jimmy Webb songs has just been recorded by Michael Feinstein. It's called Only One Life.